Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Fred Williams is on assignment. One of the world's leading experts on the ocean floor is a scientist who actually mapped so much of that floor, and his name is Chris Smoot, Christian Smoot. Well, recently we interviewed on Bob Enyart Live a textbook author, Ellen McHenry, and Christian Smoot gave Ellen permission to publish a summary of his work. So what an honor to have back in studio Ellen McHenry. Hi, Ellen. Welcome to Real Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure thing. Ellen, could you tell us about Smoot? How is it that he's such an expert on the ocean floor? Because he's one of the leading voices against plate tectonics. And I thought all secular scientists believed in plate tectonics, but he doesn't. How is it that he's an expert?
Well, his area of specialty is bathymetry, which means using sonar to map the shape of the ocean floor. Mm. And he spent 30 years working in the field. He worked for the Ocean Survey Program of the U.S. Naval Oceanographic Office from 1966 to 1998.
Wow.
And
why were they mapping? It seems obvious, but I'll ask. Why were they mapping the ocean floors?
Well, at that time, mainly it was for submarine pilots, because when you're navigating on the ocean floor, you don't want to steer into it.
Into a mountain
into
range.
Into a mountain range under the ocean.
And there are mountain ranges.
Exactly.
Under the oceans.
Yes.
So that information was classified for a long time.
Right, because we didn't want basically Russia to have access to it. So it was classified.
Yeah. And if you knew what to expect on the ocean floor, you can get places a lot faster and more safely.
Yes.
If you've got good maps, just like on the surface, same
exactly.
thing.
Exactly. Same thing.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So eventually there wasn't any need to have this information classified anymore. Mm. And so the government chose some people to declassify the information. And Smoot was one of the people that was chosen to make all this information available, mainly to scientists, because scientists
sure.
were really interested and they
Absolutely.
Wanted to know what the ocean floor looked like.
It's like mapping the moon. It's like mapping
right.
Central
right.
Asia.
Right.
We want to know. And the ocean floors, that's one of the final frontiers.
Right. And it's very expensive to have the equipment to go out and do this mapping. And not every scientist can do that.
Not.
So they want to use
and
any.
The Navy did it. So this is like getting a double bang for your buck.
Yeah.
The Navy is looking at national security, but the scientists of the world, wow, it's almost like the Human Genome Project. It's like, wow, we can have access to this data.
Right.
Now, it wasn't all released initially because there are security concerns. So 1974, I think, was the first release. And like you said, Chris Smoot, he was involved in deciding, okay, what should we release now? And then later up to the 90s, okay, what do we release?
Right. Some of it was released in 1974. And then they decided again, there was a little bit released in the 80s. And then a lot more was released in the 1990s.
So in a few minutes, we'll get into sort of the history of when these ideas for plate tectonics, when they were coming together. But right off the bat, what this is telling me, Ellen, and your summary, thank you for summarizing Smoot's work, because it's quite a slog to get through his material.
It's a bear cat to read.
He's how many papers has he published? Is it dozens of papers or just an order of magnitude?
I know it's well over 100. I think it's hundreds.
Hundreds of papers
yes.
in scientific journals.
Right.
So the guy is the real deal when it comes. He retired as a senior scientist.
Right.
And when he is releasing this material to the scientific community, declassifying it, that is actually after the theory of plate tectonics was accepted as the official story by scientists, mostly the U.S. and Western Europe, but then around the world, they had some idea, like the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. They knew that was there.
Right.
They knew the basics of the fracture zones.
Some basic fracture zones, yep.
But they didn't have the mapping of the ocean floor, so their theory was really a theory groping in the dark.
They were going on very little information.
Mm.
And one of his goals is to get students to look at his data, to look at his work, because he knows that the professional geologists that he's interacted with, they haven't listened. They're not going to listen. He's kind of given up on
them. Well, yeah, they have this paradigm,
have this paradigm.
Plate tectonics.
Exactly.
Which was framed when they didn't know what was on the ocean floor.
Right.
So if, let's say, 60% of the ocean floor contradicts plate tectonics, they didn't know that at the time.
Right.
And he's all upset. He's actually upset about all this.
Yes. And he would actually like students to have all the data before they make their mind up. He wants them to see all his data.
And from your summary, and thank you, Ellen McHenry, for giving us permission to publish your summary at Real Science Radio. So rsr.org/Ellen actually is an easy way to get to your summary. But what Smoot does then is he points out that the basic data you get from mapping the ocean floor is inconsistent with plate tectonic theory. And so he goes through some of the basics, like when we've drilled into the crust, how far down have we gotten?
Approximately 7 miles. That's just a rough estimate.
7 miles. That's barely scratching the surface. And Where did we do that? Where on the globe?
That is in northern Russia, kind of above Scandinavia. Imagine above Norway and Finland up in there.
Okay.
Yeah. It's called the Kola Super Deep Borehole.
Wow. So 7 miles deep, 12 kilometers.
Mm-hmm.
He also points out, you know, so interesting, seismic waves. When there's an earthquake and we have installed seismometers, not only all over the U.S., but around the world. And so those sound waves that result from earthquakes, they travel through rocks at different speeds. So the denser the rock, the faster they travel. So what's the difference, say, between sand versus, because there's a lot of sand in the Gulf of Mexico. It's like miles of sand deep. But then what if they're going through solid granite? What are the differences?
So in sand, it's about 800 feet per second. Granite, it's about 20,000 feet per second.
Okay. 800 feet versus about 4 miles per second. Big difference, right?
Big difference.
So if you have this equipment to register when are you hearing an earthquake, so to speak, at different points on the globe, when the seismic wave is going through the Gulf of Mexico beneath the surface, it's going to go a lot slower. When it's going through granite, a lot faster. And then the sedimentary layers, the mantle, the core. But that's basically where we're getting our information from, right? It's the speed that these seismic waves are traveling through the Earth. Right.
We have seismic waves. The only other way we can have a clue to what's down there is sometimes volcanoes will bring up chunks. It's like, imagine soup. It's like the little chunk of potato or something.
Yeah.
It'll bring up some rocks.
Yeah,
they
melted,
think that are from further down or not
solid.
Or solid. And then they'll think
and
that.
And so we get ideas of what's below the surface from volcanoes, from seismic waves. And then there's a whole field called seismic stratigraphy, which is strata that is interpreted based on the seismic waves. And so, and then also in the oceans, we dive down into the trenches, like the Marianas Trench.
Right.
But these are not the same as actually being able to go down into the mantle or go down into the core and see what's there. We're inferring this.
Right. So we really have not gone very deep into the Earth. If the Earth was an apple, the crust would be like the skin, and we haven't even broken through the skin.
Wow.
Imagine a little needle pricking it. We haven't even been through the skin yet.
And that skin is interesting in and of itself, though, right?
Right. So the skin, there's actually two types of crust. Oceanic crust is made of a rock called basalt, which is very rich in iron and magnesium. We call it mafic, M-A for magnesium, F-I-C for ferric.
So it's iron rich. So
very iron rich.
So the oceanic crust, you're talking about the crust of the Earth below the oceans.
Right.
That rock it's got a lot of iron in it.
It's got a lot of iron and a lot of magnesium in it. The continental crusts are sort of sitting on top of that. They're made mostly of granite, which is actually iron poor. So you just imagine the continents are sitting on another layer of rock, and they're pressing down into it. They're weighing down into it.
When scientists in a laboratory try to make different types of rocks, or they try to make oil, they show the process for making coal. Actually, they're pretty successful. They could make all kinds of mineral compounds we have in sedimentary layers, but when they've tried to make granite, which they've tried for a long time, they haven't been able to make granite.
That's what I've understood. Yes, they can't make granite.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Because granite, if it was molten, then the minerals would all sort out by their densities, their specific gravity.
Right.
You would find it like a layer cake.
Yeah. Another thing that would have sorted out is the really heavy elements. We shouldn't find really heavy things like uranium. They shouldn't be at the surface either.
And gold is so dense.
Right. We shouldn't find that at the surface.
If the Earth was ever molten, these things should overwhelmingly have sunk
into the middle.
Below the crust, into the mantle, and even down into the core.
Right.
That is such an argument against the whole supernova and the whole molten Earth thing.
Right.
Okay, so but back to Smoot, because Smoot is not a creationist.
Right.
He is not a young earther.
Right.
He is saying that the plate tectonics crowd has ignored the data for their story.
Yes.
He gives a history of geologic thought, and you could get this really anywhere. I've gotten it from a PhD in the history of geology, worked with Answers in Genesis, Ken Ham, Dr. Terry Mortensen. He got his PhD, Ellen, from Coventry University in England. And so PhD in the history of geology, he knows quite a bit about the topic. But Smoot gives us like a thumbnail sketch. Could you share that with us?
Well, the first step away from flood geology, which is actually what people thought for hundreds of years, was to theorize that much of the geology of Europe was caused by an ice age.
Okay.
And then James Hutton wrote a paper in 1785 called The Theory of the Earth, or An Investigation of the Laws Observable in the Composition, Dissolution, and Restoration of Land Upon the Globe.
Okay,
long
so they're
titles
wrestling
don't fly
with,
anymore.
They're, right. So they're wrestling with trying to figure out how did this all get the way it is? And the ice age figured prominently. But it's interesting that first it was the global flood.
At first, everyone believed the global flood, yes.
Geology.
Yes.
And really, that goes back through the centuries because of the Bible saying that the mountains rose up in a day, that the mountains were covered by the floodwaters. So for people who thought about these things, for centuries, it was a flood, and it became known as flood geology. And when the geologists themselves write a history of their discipline, they start with flood geology.
Right. Everybody does, because that's what everybody thought.
Right. So James Hutton, you mentioned, that was 1785.
He theorized that our present rocks were formed by the wastes of rocks of past eras. So that's kind of the beginning of the rock cycle idea.
Okay, yeah. And sedimentary rock, you can get where he'd be thinking, because sandstone is made up of grains.
Right.
Limestone is a sedimentary rock. But then if granite was made up of the waste of previous eras of rock, how do you form granite? And there his theory, I think, would come to a screeching halt.
Right.
Because it could not explain granite.
Right, one would think. Then next came Charles Lyell with his principle of uniformitarianism. And he wrote a famous book called Principles of Geology in 1829.
Yeah.
And this was the book that Darwin took on his voyages. This is what he was reading when he was sailing.
When he's on the Beagle.
Yep, on the Beagle.
And he goes to the Galapagos Islands. And it's interesting that even mainstream geologists will look at Charles Lyell's explanation of the geology that Charles Darwin was looking at, and they'll say, well, you know what? Lyell was wrong here. Lyell was wrong here. Lyell was wrong here. And there's been so much even among mainstream geologists, where they've been overturning Lyell and his uniformitarianism.
Right. This was so important. That was the most important thing that Lyell did, was to get people to assent to this idea of uniformitarianism, which means the present is the key to the past. Mm. So we know how fast sediments are forming now, and we just do the calculation, and we can calculate how old. So there's that was the end of catastrophism. Right there, the uniformitarian, that was a major shift in the thoughts of geologists. It just can't be emphasized enough.
An example of the victory of catastrophism over Lyell was the whole Missoula flood, where the geologist that he went to his grave fighting this battle, and eventually mainstream geology said, hey, you know what? Lake Missoula was a massive lake with an ice dam that breached, and we ended up with the scablands.
Yeah, it's like geologists are allergic to catastrophism.
Yes. A little footnote that about the history of geology, the Geological Society of London. Ellen, I think there are only two people in the world who know what I'm about to say. Me and Terry Mortensen.
It was news to
me. PhD. Yeah, we talked about this right before the show. The Geological Society, which is the world's oldest, of London, it was made up mostly of lawyers, and their motivation, they were lawyers. Their motivation was to undermine the monarchy. That's what they wanted to do. So how would Charles Lyell help them undermine the monarchy? Well, if Lyell is right, Moses was wrong. And wasn't that a goal of Lyell's?
Right. In fact, Charles Lyell said that his goal was to free geology from Moses.
From, in other words, the global flood, Genesis.
Exactly.
That Jesus told us that Moses wrote about the global flood, which killed all of mankind.
Right.
Noah's Ark. Jesus talked about all those details.
Right.
So they wanted to undermine the monarchy, because with a monarchy, the model is that authority flows from God downhill through government leaders to the people. But a humanist view, like the French Revolution and all, is that authority flows uphill from the people to the governing authorities, and there is no God. Forget about God. So these lawyers in London wanted to undermine a biblical worldview with authority from God. And so if they could destabilize or discredit the monarchy, that would help promote their rebellious worldview. And what better way to do that than to say that Genesis is wrong? So let's celebrate geology, which proves uniformitarianism old age.
And then biologists started helping, because, of course, Darwin is kind of where biology meets geology.
Right.
And the biologists wanted to get rid of Moses also. So at this point, biology and geology kind of formed an alliance. Mm.
As these geologists are laying out their ideas, of course, they're trying to explain not only what we see, but they should also be able to explain, if their theory is right, earthquakes, volcanoes, ocean trenches, which they weren't able to see back then.
Right.
A good theory should be able to explain those things. And what's interesting, Ellen, ultimately we're talking about arguments against plate tectonics. There are so many earthquakes that are not on the plate boundaries. They're interior to the plate.
Interior, yes.
And so they contradict in a big way. It's like a neon sign. There's something wrong with plate tectonics because there are so many earthquakes inside of the plates themselves.
Yes, and Smoot points that out several times in his work. Yep.
So going through the history then, we're sort of coming toward plate tectonics. But what came next?
Well, next, of course, they're open to ideas, trying to theorize why does everything look the way it does? So this guy named Alfred Wegener came up with a theory of continental drift, although there were a few people that had theorized this before him. He actually wasn't the first, but this is
That's often the case, isn't
it? Yeah, when you really look into it.
The people who get the credit for it.
Yes,
yeah.
This idea had actually been floating around, but he really picked up on this idea because he noticed what we call now the Bullard fit. And you see this in children's textbooks everywhere now. If you slide North and South America over a bit and kind of match it up with Africa and Europe, they kind of
There's a sense that they look like they go together.
Yeah, they're like puzzle pieces that go together.
This was back in the 1920s. And that idea sort of stuck even till today. Dr. Walt Brown, with his model of the global flood based on the fountains of the Great Deep, he points out that there are actually problems with that model. Africa is way too big. You got to shrink it by 30%. You got to rotate Europe. But Smoot gives his own problems with that idea. Maybe we'll get to that later.
Yes, he has another problem with it. So the next idea that came along was that the Earth's crust is a series of plates that have areas of tectonic activity between them. This was Gutenberg and Richter in 1949 who proposed this idea.
So we're getting real close to the time of plate tectonics.
Right, we got some plates.
We could see we got the continents moving in the 1920s. These two guys in almost 1950 say, well, there's a series of these plates and there's something going on between the plates.
Right.
That's pretty interesting.
Then a scientist named Hugo Benioff discovered large thrust faults, which would be areas.
A fault is a break in a rock, right?
It's a break, right.
Geologists talk about faults, but that's just where rock is broken.
Right. So these broken areas are along the rim of the Pacific, and these areas bear his name. We call them Benioff zones, and they're all along the western side of the Pacific.
Okay. So he discovered these apparently using seismic data.
Yes.
He said, okay, here are these regions where there are faults and they're thrust faults, like something's being pushed and the rock is breaking.
Right. And he looked at a lot of earthquake data and he knew something was going on there because wherever you have a lot of earthquakes, something's moving around.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't really know exactly what was going on, but they knew that these areas were a clue.
Another key part of the development of this idea came in 1960.
So then a scientist named Bruce Heazen in 1960 began looking at the mid-ocean rift system.
That's the mountain range right in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Runs north-south.
Right. So he thought maybe this was a clue. This had something to do with what was going on.
In fact, he thought there's something dynamic about it, that it's not just a stationary fixture.
Right, that there could be something going on there that was causing a lot of this tectonic activity.
So and just then, 2 years later.
And 2 years later, Harry Hess and Bob Dietz theorized seafloor spreading, that what was going on at this area in the middle of the Atlantic, this mountain range, was actually growing new ocean floor right there at the middle of the Atlantic.
And that term, seafloor spreading, which is synonymous with plate tectonics today, they say that the mantle is coming up. And wherever you see a mid-oceanic ridge, like right down the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, it's spreading apart and pushing east and west.
Right. And there would be new seafloor occurring right there. And the old floor is kind of like on a conveyor belt going out to the sides.
And if you radiometrically date that rock, it should all support that that's brand new.
It's brand new.
Rock.
To give very young ages. And the oldest radiometric ages are very far away.
Because
from the
ridge. When you radiometrically date a rock, you're dating, theoretically, how much time has passed since it solidified, when it was magma, and then it froze. How long ago did that happen?
Right.
So they think if they radiometrically date those rocks, they'll find, hey, these are relatively brand new compared to rock far away from the mid-Atlantic ridge, for example. Bob Dietz, you mentioned, we talk about him in our video, The Global Flood and the Hydroplate Theory. He and Walt Brown were friends. They spent about a year together once a week in Dietz's office at Arizona State University. I attended there for a couple of years. And Dietz, this world-renowned geologist, and Walt, they would spend an afternoon together. They'd go hear a geology speaker in the evening. And the Arizona Republic, you remember, Ellen, they had this article, Bob Dietz and Walt Brown are going to debate.
Mm-hmm.
This big debate, highly publicized, and about a week before the debate, Dietz pulled out. And so interesting, part of history. So Ellen McHenry, and again, thank you for the summary of Smoot's work, because his stuff is pretty hard to read.
It's pretty hard to read.
It brings you to 1966. That's the big year in the history of plate tectonics, because at the GSA annual conference, the Geological Society of America, they're meeting in San Francisco, and they accepted the whole ball of wax. They accepted the whole theory, plate tectonics, seafloor spreading, and then if new mantle surface is coming up in the ocean ridges, somewhere it's got to be diving back down into the mantle. And they said that was at subduction zones.
Right.
Right. And so 1966, they say, okay, that's it. We have our model. Until today, that's it. If you're going to be a professional geologist and accepted in the journals Nature and Science, you have to support plate tectonics. You can't be a dissenter. And what's interesting about that date is that was 8 years before Chris Smoot began to declassify the ocean floor data.
Yes, he points that out again and again in his work.
It's
too bad they didn't know anything about the ocean floor when they made this theory.
They were groping in the dark, but some things are too big to fail, like Darwinism.
Yep.
Darwinism, that was before we knew about genetics and we knew about regulatory DNA and their whole coding for protein, junk DNA. It's all so erroneous, but it's too big to fail. They developed that before we learned all these things. And it's all obviously false, falsified 1,000 times over, but it's clung to with a blind faith.
Yes. So this is the equivalent in geology. So this is the paradigm that you have to accept. This is what's taught in every university now, unquestioned. And if you don't accept this theory,
you're not going to be an editor at the journal Nature, I'll tell you that.
You're not going to be an editor at the journal Nature.
So the Benioff zones that you mentioned, that's where, like in the Pacific, they find a handful of these where they think the plates are diving down into the mantle.
Right. So an oversimplification, we need to think of the seafloor in the Pacific going west and kind of diving under Asia.
Yeah, like
it's a little more complicated than that, but
yeah,
sort of.
So sort of like a conveyor belt, and it comes up from in the Atlantic at the mid-oceanic ridge. You've got new surface mantle being formed, the plates, plate tectonics, and that's heading to the west when you think of the Americas, or to the east if you think of Africa and Asia. And it's heading to the west, and then somewhere it's got to dive back down in.
Right.
To the mantle. And so they say that's at these Benioff zones.
Right. And then they realized there really weren't enough diving areas.
Yeah.
Okay. So they had to include, well, the other option is the seafloor could be diving or it could be colliding and crumpling up into mountains.
So it could either rise up as mountain ranges or sink down ocean trenches.
Right. So you need kind of a neutral word that doesn't mean up or down. So we call it convergent, where they converge, and it can be converging up.
So divergent zones are the seafloor spreading at the ridges, and the convergence is where they're knocking together.
Right, either up or down.
One is going under the other, or they're buckling up to form mountains.
Right, either one.
Minor problems with these ideas. There's three times more spreading zones than there are convergent zones. Three times, more than 3-to-1 difference. So Smoot points this out repeatedly. It's like, well, where's it all going to?
Right. It has to be going somewhere, because if you're creating new seafloor all the time, it's not going somewhere, then the crust of the earth is getting larger.
Yeah. So think about it's more than 3-to-1. But let's say you had 10,000 miles of seafloor spreading where it's making new mantle plates. And then you have only 3,000 miles where it's all supposed to be subducting.
Right. Where's the 7 going?
Where is the rest of it going?
Right.
It doesn't fit. And the Earth doesn't show that it's all being squeezed through a funnel to subduct in these tiny little areas. And also, Ellen, that's the problem with the subduction zones. But if they were forming mountain ranges, the mountain ranges are what? A mile, 2 miles, 3 miles high. You've got thousands of miles of mantle plates coming at you.
Yeah.
You can't explain it all away by a tiny little bump of a mountain range.
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, so the geometry problem of plate tectonics, which is funny from a creationist perspective, because famed young earth creationist Dr. John Baumgartner has long criticized Walt Brown's hydroplate theory. He said it has a geometry problem. And what's so funny about that is plate tectonics, it reeks of a geometry problem. We've done our RSR answers, hydroplate theory objections. We did a whole show on the geometry problem. Real easy to answer. But the plate tectonics industry has never answered their geometry problem.
And they have multiple geometry problems. That's just one we've discussed. There's more.
So, Ellen, I see from your summary, the next thing on our plate here are hot spots and all smooth. He knows that they're bogus. So many people do. But we're out of time for today's show. Could we do a part two and continue this?
Sure. That'll be a lot of fun.
Okay. I am loving it. I mean, how many people could you talk about plate tectonics with in your normal life? Do you have people in Pennsylvania who all around you who always want to talk about this stuff?
No, not really.
Not really. So it really is an honor. Ellen, you and I have been friends for quite a while now, long distance. But you coming to Colorado, and it's really been fun getting to talk with you.
Well, it's really fun to have someone to talk plate tectonics with.
Well, thank you. Okay, so this is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. May God bless you.